This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Unity through the 6 degrees of separation, that there were some hippie artists living on a ship in Hoboken, and they had a crane and a boom truck and knew how to use them. The other problem was that the sculptors were used to having traditional rigging companies move sculpture, and there was a poor fit between the aesthetics of some of these riggers with their antique equipment and greasy handprints and snarky comments about the artwork. So the sculpture crowd was glad to find people who were a little more sympathetic and sensitive. And we began moving multi-million dollars piece of sculpture in and out of fifth floor windows in museums in New York. We formed relationships with people that we certainly never would have gotten to know had we been shopping our slides and looking for representation.
So you had been to RISD, the Rhode Island School of Design, and you were a painter, or you wanted to be an artist at that point? You were early 20s at this point, right?
Correct. I had majored in sculpture. I was there for 2 years. By the middle of my sophomore year, I realized I really just wanted to make art. I wasn't interested in teaching it. I didn't need a piece of paper to tell me I was ready. So I left to go ahead and begin making art on my own.
Mm-hmm. So you're living in New York, and you had this, you're living on a giant, what seems to me a giant boat in Hoboken in the water, and you turned it into livable quarters, is that right?
Well, initially the idea was just studio space and liveaboard, and I became enamored of the maritime life, sort of slid down the slippery slope into the water, got my captain's license, learned to dive, began doing salvage operations in the New York Harbor. So some of those spaces got turned into machine shops and fabrication mm-hmm. spaces, put cranes on the vessel, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So you had exposure to this sort of, you know, you got your hands dirty, basically, while also wanting to be an artist. So if we kind of fast forward to now, looking in the gallery, there's a really good painting of Chinatown in San Francisco. And you see everything, all the cables above the trolleys and the Muni cars. Just tell me what happened when you were painting that picture, how long it took, and what else happened?
So that painting was a bit of a calling card. I was looking for representation in San Francisco. I really put my all into it. It turned out to be about 8 months of 8 hours a day. And I'm naturally curious about the vernacular names for much of what I paint because of that hands-on experience. So I did a little research, found the Muni engineers responsible for the maintenance of those overhead wires, and they said, hey, send us a picture, we'll walk you through it. And of course, there were great stories about all of that equipment, the names for it, which I got a chuckle out of and had to ask him to slow down so I could write it all down fast enough and posted it beside the painting. But the names for those 600-volt DC trolley wires, pretty funny stuff, insulating sticks and bobs, Johnny balls, Nobos with tip bolts, and Dorigos with belt hangers. And this guy rattled it all off and explained the system, which I found very interesting and helped to inform the actual painting.
So you'd taken photos of that corner and you were painting 8 hours a day. And when it was done, the painting was done.
So at that point, I have a high-roofed mobile van, which is set up as a gallery, and I took the painting down to San Francisco to show it to some people. And it's fully lit. You can walk into the van, and it's almost like being in a small gallery. I took it to the Muni headquarters, and the guys who actually spend their lives maintaining that wire got a big thrill out of being able to see the painting. So that was a fun experience for me.
So you're like in their workshop and they have all the wires kind of laid out.
Exactly.
On the ceiling.
They have a duplicate system overhead in the building.
Yeah. At your studio, so you say you have a mobile studio, right? a Sprinter van?
Well, that van is really more of a gallery than a studio.
Gallery,
but
yeah.
I do use it for painting on scene as well.
Mm-hmm. And then, I've been to a studio in North Portland, or I guess, would you call it Linton?
Northwest.
Yeah.
Rural Northwest Portland.
Okay. Just beyond Linton. So you've got a kind of steel plates on the walls of your studio, and then there are these wooden things that look like rulers, and they have magnets on the end. So just explain why you have those.
So I built a steel house because I was a little nervous about the seismic realities of where we live. And it would seem that if you're going to work on a painting 8 hours a day for 8 months, the last thing you'd want to do in your seismically reinforced house is have a little tremor and have that painting fall on the floor. Mm-hmm. So that was one impetus to try and come up with an easel system that secured these large paintings, but at the same time left them maneuverable so that I could move them at will, rotate them, change their orientation for the ease in painting. Mm-hmm. So the steel walls in combination with some magnetic switched permanent magnets let me attach the paintings to the wall, mm-hmm. and at the same time mall sticks, which are rests that permit you to work in the center of a wet oil painting, can be attached magnetically to the wall as well, mm-hmm. without any visual clutter. So when I back up to look at the painting, rather than the traditional easel framework around the painting is just floating on the wall as though it were hung, mm-hmm. which is a much easier way for me to work.
Right. So these wooden things, they're just off the surface and you can lean on them?
Correct.
Like a sign painter leans on that thing.
Exactly. I mean, mall sticks, M-A-H-L, is the traditional thing that you see a classic painter holding in his hand and resting against. Mm-hmm. But you need an extra hand to hold that as well, whereas mm-hmm. these are held in place and with one flick of the switch can be maneuvered to any other position.
Right. You can like turn the magnets on and off.
Exactly. And they span the entire painting in any direction.
Yeah. And also the lighting in your place is pretty amazing. You're like sort of pioneer of LED lighting.
Right. I actually found that I didn't like the hot spots of individual bulbs and fixtures, so I was searching for a more uniform light. I had settled on standard quartz halogen outdoor fixtures, but at 300 watts, both the heat, power consumption, and UV effects are not ideal for studio work. Mm-hmm. So I kept hoping for the Holy Grail, which would be an LED equivalent, which just now is becoming available in LEDs that are truly color balanced for artwork. Mm-hmm. So I have some breadboarded prototype fixtures that I use there.
So you were looking for a light that looked like daylight, basically.
Correct. And had, most importantly, an even color spectrum, rather than the traditional spikes that are found in much of the so-called art lighting today.
Mm-hmm. So you found you would paint something and then the red would look different in the gallery.
Absolutely, alarmingly so.
Right. This is Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. My guest this week is Seth Tane. He's a realist painter with a show at 929 Northwest Flanders up until this Saturday. So when I look at a realist painting, I often spend a lot of time just wondering how real it is and could it be more like a photo or less? Would a photo have done just as well? So I kind of focus on form, which I think can sometimes be a bit distracting. So what do you, how do you place what you do in the sort of history of art? Why are you painting realistically from photos?
First and foremost, it's the way I see, and I think many of us see the world in a, quote, representational manner. I think that this is common across great gulfs of time, and it's cross-cultural around the world. So it's in a very accessible language. And I think yet we relate very differently to paintings and photographs. I think that they both have very strong representational characteristics, but there's an allowance that we make when we look at paintings. Mm-hmm. I think that we are willing to suspend a certain amount of faithfulness, if you will, in favor of the kinds of painterly touches that distinguish paintings from a mechanically reproduced object like a photograph. And although I've spent time as a commercial photographer, I revere photography, I love looking at it, there's something about painting itself that is a kind of magic activity and has an awe about it that I find I don't get from even the same reference photograph I'm using to paint from, no matter how well printed.
Yeah. It is pretty amazing because on the Chinatown picture, you've got sort of white molding on the building, sort of a in the bright San Francisco sun with shadow. And it's kind of mesmerizing looking at that, thinking, you know, this was done by hand. And also, how did the painter decide what to do and what to kind of leave out, basically? When are things going to be in super focus, or when are they just going to be a brush stroke?
And many of those decisions, of course, are made on the fly as you're painting. There are many times I'll paint a passage over and over and over again. In fact, the very one you're talking about, the shadows of those fire escapes, just didn't look right the first couple times. Sometimes it's the amount of detail or its focus. Sometimes it has to do with color balance or its relation to an adjacent patch in the painting. But it's one of those you know it when you see it moments, and that's the creative aspect of it, really.
Right.
It's not merely duplicative of a photograph.
That's probably why it took you 8 months, right?
A part of the reason. And I certainly will admit to learning on the job here.
Yeah. And those pictures were done because you love San Francisco, right? And just you used to pilot ships into the bay there, or what? What were you doing?
There was a period recently where I was serving as a federal court-appointed monitor in a big pollution case against an oil company, and I had the opportunity to ride million-barrel, thousand-foot tankers into San Francisco Bay and Puget Sound and back and forth to Valdez, Alaska. So I found myself increasingly in San Francisco on these trips, and while I had spent time there previously, really became captivated by the light and color.
So you in the show, you have a lot of pictures of ships from kind of very close. You've shot them from the water. You know, initially, the perspective is you're on the water in a kayak or something, or a little boat, and you're looking up at these gigantic ships,
which is something I've always found fascinating. And for a period in my maritime career, I was running a launch or small boat out to ships both underway and at anchor, and it's indescribably captivating to approach such a large object, which is sculptural, quite frankly, in such a small vessel. And the combination of the change in vantage point and the respective difference in the sizes is fascinating, absolutely fascinating, even more so when both vessels are underway. So that vantage point is something that's always stuck with me, and I've done paintings from that vantage point for many years.
Yeah. And do you still go out on the water now?
As much as I possibly can. In fact, the day before the opening, I was sailing in the Columbia.
What were you on?
At that point, a little folding sailing trimaran kayak called a Hobie Adventure Island.
A kayak?
A sailing kayak, which actually is kind of poignant. I was able to trade a 21-year-old painting of a ship done from the vantage point of a small vessel to a sailboat dealer for that vessel. So I thought that was very appropriate.
So you also said to me that when you look at an industrial painting, you know, by somebody else, and you notice the artist has got some details wrong, because they don't really know about steel and cables and buoys and all that stuff, train tracks, that it annoys you. So why does it annoy you?
Well, sorry about that. I'm not trying to be patronizing, but I spent more than 20 years actually doing all that heavy-duty stuff, welding, rigging, diving, building and operating boats and machinery under demanding and perilous conditions, as well as manufacturing marine structures. So I really felt so intimately involved with those things that it gives me a perspective that's unlike most painters who only know the images rather than the reality of those objects. And certainly that's not true in all cases, but frequently. In fact, for me, I get a little bit of a perverse thrill frequently of painting something that I know all too well would have taken me weeks of work if I were to actually be building the real object.
Mm-hmm. The point of realism in the age of photography, I know we talked about this already. Is your sense of reality or realism related to your intimacy with these things? Are they more real for you because you know them better than other people?
I wouldn't presume to say that. I just say that there is a particular knowledge built on that familiarity that informs my work. At the same time, my work is intentional in that I'm frequently very aware as I'm seeing things of how they're affecting me. So I'm consciously photographing and documenting those things in preparation for painting. So despite the historical questions that have been asked about the validity of, for instance, realism in this age of technical reproduction, I feel very strongly that painting is in and of itself something of intrinsic value. I know that I have serious questions about the differences between the justification for making luxury one-of-a-kind objects in this world, given the financial and social realities. That then calls into question if I were able to reproduce or print these paintings, and we're getting very close to true fidelity in that regard, mm-hmm. would those objects have as much significance as the original paintings? So that's a little bit of a twist on the question, but in many ways, I think, a more interesting avenue.
Mm-hmm. So I always ask people what sort of music they listen to when they're working. Well, how about you?
Well, unfortunately, I have an embarrassingly limited and mostly old school playlist of rock and folk classics with occasional leavening from my son's collections. Talking Heads, The Stones, Kinks, Patti Smith, Presidents, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, Joan Jett, Tom Paxton, Phil Oakes, Joni Mitchell, Ry Cooter, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So you brought in a bit of music. It's Steve Miller, and the song is called Living in the USA.
Correct.
That was Living in the USA by Steve Miller. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO. And this is Joseph Gallivan talking to Seth Tane. And Seth, you come from Long Island, New York, and you lived in Manhattan a lot. But you said you had an attraction to the West. And just tell us what that is and how you ended up in Portland.
Well, I sort of felt switched at birth, curiously enough, and I can't really account for where I got these images, but I can remember being as young as 5 years old and fantasizing about the West as a place of dramatic scenery and adventure. It was really a contrast to those banal Long Island suburbs I grew up in and mm-hmm. got here as soon as I can and have enjoyed it ever since.
Was it inspired by TV?
I really can't say. I don't know where those images would have come from, but it was embedded in my consciousness.
Uh-huh. So after college, how did you get to Portland?
I actually came through the first time that summer after high school and headed back to RISD via a freight train. I hopped in Portland that mm-hmm. summer. So that was the summer of 71.
Wow. And then you came here, and before you ever did the ship in New York, you were living in Portland.
Right. I came back. I actually lived in Albuquerque, New Mexico after RISD for about 11 months, and then moved back to Portland, or to Portland for the first time, 74, left in 79 to live on the ship in New York. Right. And then back here again in 93, and I've been here ever since.
Right. So this is where you brought your kids back, and you grew up. They grew up in the Northwest?
Correct.
In the woods?
Yes.
Right, okay. So you're at this gallery at the corner of 9th and Flanders. People know it as the Pulliam Deffenbaugh space, which is empty. And then you've kind of appeared in there a couple of months ago, and you've got your work up. And what is it? It looks like self-publishing. So what's the setup there?
Well, everyone's got to eat. And although I did all these things for all these years and have no regret about it, I'm now painting full time and there is no plan B. So I've depleted my meager savings that I managed to accumulate, and I've got acquired skills from a life as a serial entrepreneur. So it kind of behooves me to try and find ways to promote my work to a wider public and make a living from this activity, which I find joyous and all-consuming. That gallery was available because it was in between owners, and the idea came to me that as a perfect turnkey space, it would give me the opportunity to have complete control over the show, which you rarely have in a standard gallery situation. So all that whining about the lights and the improper framing and the choice of work, it was really up to me to do it the way I wanted, and I was able to hire gallerists to run it for me, who had closed another gallery in town, and that really has worked out very well.
Mm-hmm. And you're pretty hands-on. You make the frames or you'll custom finish the frames for your work, whereas I don't think a lot of artists do get that involved.
Well, I have all those tools in the shop, and I've got to justify it somehow, so I do what I have to do.
Yeah, you've got a giant steel workshop with its own crane at the back, which is like a it looks like the crane, if anyone's read the kids' book, Mike Mulligan and his steam shovel, it looks like one of those sort of old-school crane. So what do you use that for?
Well, that's a great old 1956 American diesel crawler crane, which I brought to the property because it looked like it would be useful. I put another 20-foot of jib on it and recabled it, and then I used it to build our house, which is a steel-framed house, and came in very handy for that.
Right. So your actual house is like built like a ship.
Very much correct? So, yes. It's a labor of love in a way, but I only wanted to do it once, and given the seismic risks, I figured steel was the way to go.
Right. So it's on a concrete pad?
Correct.
And if there's an earthquake, it'll just stay where it is?
Well, I don't know about it staying where it is, but it should stay in the same relative orientation, so I could drag it back up the hill and move back in.
Whereas your neighbors will be like in a pool of mud.
Well, we don't want to wish ill on anyone.
No, but it's unstable ground, right?
Indeed.
Right. It overlooks Sovies Island, if anyone can picture that, and the river. It's pretty inspiring view out of the window of his studio. So you've got this gallery going on just till Saturday. I guess artists kind of wonder where you fit into the Portland art scene. There's an art scene and there's a gallery scene. How do you get noticed? And also you've got connections in New York, so you're kind of lucky in that sense. So where do you fit in the Portland gallery scene?
Well, it's a good question, and I don't know the answer to it. And this gallery experience was really an attempt to widen the exposure. Although I've been painting for decades and I've been here in Portland off and on for decades, I'm still relatively unknown. The New York scene is a great opportunity, but you have to approach it cautiously, of course. Mm-hmm. So I'm working many different angles, if you will, to try and gain increased exposure. And I'm certainly available to be able to discuss the work with anyone.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you've also done pictures that include people's faces recently. There's a New York subway scene where everyone's kind of, getting off the train and heading for the exits. Tell us about that picture.
Well, with a few exceptions, in my youth, I rarely have included faces and figures in paintings up until recently. And I turned around on a crowded subway platform staircase on Wall Street one evening and shot wall-to-wall people covering every inch of the platform and decided this was an opportunity. And I'm pedaling as fast as I can, but it's a humbling and very enjoyable activity to try and capture our natural fascination with the human face and figure.
So these faces, they look kind of look a little bit blurred, or, you know, not all the features are there. It's not, they obviously did some editing from the photo. So what is it about painting the human face that differs from, you know, an inanimate object?
Well, we identify emotions with facial features so directly that I laugh to myself. You can paint the side of a ship or a rail car, and you pretty much have carte blanche. You start making marks on a human face, and pretty quickly our read of that emotion changes. So it's very demanding and at the same time very gratifying to be able to capture that sort of subtlety in paint.
So it's pretty difficult.
Very difficult.
What kind of thing happens if you put like one mark wrong on an eye or something?
Oh, I mean, the expression goes from laughter to tears in an instant.
I'm Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBO Radio. This week, our guest was Seth Tane. His current show is called New York, New Work, and it runs until April 13th, that's this Saturday. And it's at 929 Northwest Flanders. Thanks for coming in, Seth.
Thank you very much for having me, Joseph.
And next week, Ava Lake will have Brian Fariso on of the Portland Art Museum. Andy Warhol, Mr. Scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, Silver Screen, can't tell them apart at all.
Developer Dennis Sackoff is reapplying for a permit to finish the halfway done 81 apartment unit building at Southeast Division and 37th Avenue. But like last year, and the reason construction couldn't be completed, his representatives had to meet with Richmond neighbors who have opposed the project last night. Richmond neighbors are upset that there will be no on-site parking, and not much headway was made at yesterday's meeting. Both parties are waiting to hear if another permit will be issued before moving forward in strategy. MSN did a story recently on how Portland's rental prices are going up, and it's getting worse. In fact, real estate research firm Reese Inc. predicted that Portland will be one of the top 10 cities with the highest price increase of 2013 by 4.7%. It is believed that prices are rising because more and more people prefer the less hassle of renting. However, there aren't many properties available. Clay Newton, broker with CV Newton Company, said Portland is now one of the nation's tightest rental markets. John Holskamp put a sign in the back of his pickup truck saying, "Say yes to our schools. 52 kids in a class is too many." He parked his truck in his usual spot at Sunset High School, where his daughter attends school and he works as the principal. Holskamp is using his sign to draw attention to Beaverton School District's proposal on the May ballot to levy the district with an additional $5 million in order to protect it from making more teacher cuts. The school district has already had to cut $37 million in its budget and therefore 100 teacher positions, leaving unusually high class sizes like Holskamp's daughter's algebra class. This is Desiree Garcia with KBOO News.